turn. Alan Gleicher, who worked with Bill as the head of sales and operations at Intuit, had a simple way of summing up how to be successful with him. Don't dance. If Bill asks a question and you don't know the answer, don't dance around it. Tell him you don't know. For Bill, honesty and integrity weren't just about keeping your word and telling the truth. They were also about being forthright. This is critical for effective coaching. A good coach doesn't hide the stuff that's hard to talk about. In fact, a good coach will draw this out. He or she gets at the hard stuff. Scholars would describe Bill's approach, listening, providing honest feedback, demanding candor, as relational transparency, which is a core characteristic of authentic leadership. Wharton professor Adam Grant has another term for it, disagreeable givers. He notes in an email to us that we often feel torn between supporting and challenging others. Social scientists reach the same conclusion for leadership as they do for parenting. It's a false dichotomy. You want to be supportive and demanding, holding high standards and expectations, but giving the encouragement necessary to reach them. Basically, it's tough love. Disagreeable givers are gruff and tough on the surface, but underneath they have others' best interests at heart. They give the critical feedback no one wants to hear, but everyone needs to hear. Research on organizations shows what Bill seemed to know instinctively, that these leadership traits lead to better team performance. One study of a chain of retail stores found that when employees saw their managers as authentic, for example, agreeing that the manager says exactly what he or she means, the employees trusted the leaders more, and the stores had higher sales. Don't stick it in their ear. Don't tell people what to do. Offer stories and help guide them to the best decisions for them. Be the evangelist for courage. In 2014, Twitter was negotiating a partnership deal with Google that would allow Google to include tweets in its search results. Dick Costolo, Twitter's CEO at the time, was working with his team on the deal. There were a lot of concerns about the terms, so the team was advocating a smaller deal to test things out first. Dick updated Bill on the progress at his next coaching one-on-one. "This is onesie-twosie stuff," Bill told him. Dick shouldn't nibble around the edges. He should push for the boldest solution possible. If he was going to do something big, there was no way to anticipate all the smaller details and problems, so maybe sign a shorter-term deal. But the main point was to go big. "There's a big idea here. Come up with a more courageous path forward." Dick got the team to be more aggressive, and a few months later, they announced a deal to give Google access to Twitter's data stream. Bill's perspective was that it's a manager's job to push the team to be more courageous. Courage is hard. People are naturally afraid of taking risks for fear of failure. It's the manager's job to push them past their reticence. Shauna Brown, a longtime Google executive, calls it being an evangelist for courage. As a coach, Bill was a never-ending evangelist for courage. As Bill Gurley notes, he blew confidence into people. He believed you could do things, even when you yourself weren't so sure, always pushing you to go beyond your self-imposed limits. Danny Shader, founder and CEO of Payneer Me, who worked with Bill at Go. "The thing I got the most out of meetings with Bill is courage. I always came away thinking, I can do this. He believed you could do stuff that you didn't believe you could do." Emil Michael says, "He would always convey boldness to me. It would always give me such a boost. That's one thing I learned from Bill. Be the person who gives energy, not one who takes it away." This quality of constant encouragement, of being the person to give energy, has been shown to be one of the most important aspects of effective coaching. For example, a 2011 study from the Ashridge Business School in the United Kingdom ranks encouragement as the third most appreciated quality in a coach, behind only listening and understanding. Shishir Malhotra started his first company, Centrata, in 2001. Not long afterward, he got a call from one of his investors. The company was struggling and needed to cut expenses. The investor had gone through the resumes of everyone in the company and chosen the people he felt should be laid off. They were mostly the more junior people in the company. The investor thought the company needed to retain its more experienced people. The problem was, most of the people the investor had selected were Shishir's co-founders. Shishir didn't think letting them go was a smart move, but when pressed by the investor, he did it. Then he called Bill. Bill was furious. Where was Shishir's courage? His constant advice to me, even back then, was to trust my instincts, Shishir says. I was 22 years old. Bill asked Shishir, did he think laying off all the junior staff was the right thing to do? Shishir's answer was no. These people are the co-founders. They care more. The more senior people are more like mercenaries. They'll leave as soon as things go south. Bill coached Shishir to have the courage to follow his instincts, so he turned around and rehired the people he had just laid off. They formed the core of the company for the next several years. Conveying boldness was not blind cheerleading on Bill's part. He had the mindset that most people have value, and he had the experience and a good enough eye for talent that he generally knew what he was talking about. He had such credibility that if he said that you could do something, you believed him. Not because he was a cheerleader, but because he was a coach and experienced executive. He built his message on your capabilities and progress. This is a key aspect of delivering encouragement as a coach. It needs to be credible. A 2014 research paper from Y. Joel Wong of Indiana University shows that perceived trustworthiness of the encourager is an important characteristic in differentiating effective encouragement from blind cheerleading. And if you believed him, you started to believe in yourself, which of course helped you achieve whatever daunting task lay before you. He gave me permission to go forth. Alphabet CFO Ruth Porat says, to have confidence in my judgment. This confidence is even more important when things are rough. Millard Mickey Drexler, the former CEO of J. Crew and Gap, who sat on the Apple board for 16 years alongside Bill, is a firm believer in the CEO as coach model, particularly in challenging times. When things are bad, people come into work every day getting beat up. Everyone feels awful. As a leader, you can't fix problems on your own, and you can't fix them when morale is down. So you need to build the confidence of the team. Bill set high standards for his coachees. He believed they could be great, greater than what they believed. This created an aspiration for each of us, and disappointment when we thought that we were not living up to that aspiration. Bill set the bar higher for us than we set it for ourselves. And when you approach people with that mindset, they respond. Be the evangelist for courage. Believe in people more than they believe in themselves, and push them to be more courageous. Full identity, front and center. David Drummond is Alphabet's head of corporate development and legal affairs, and is an African American. When you come from a background that is not traditional, if you're black, you don't typically fit in, David says. There is a strong pressure to conform and not show that part of yourself. In Silicon Valley, you are supposed to be either technical or from a fancy business school. Bill Campbell was neither, but he still, as David puts it, put his full identity front and center. Bill and David talked about this, with Bill counseling David that so much about him was where he came from, and that he should hang on to that as a source of motivation and strength. He made me less self-conscious about the fact that I wasn't the same as everyone, that I was black. One thing we learned from interviewing people for this book was how much Bill encouraged people to be themselves at work, well before the bringing your whole self meme became so popular. This isn't something we ever heard directly from him. White heterosexual males who attended top schools, that is, us, don't typically have issues with being themselves at their workplace. But as a guy from a working-class town, a former football coach with a non-technical degree who parachuted into Silicon Valley in the early 1980s, Bill had some experience with feeling out of place. Yet he was always fully himself, and he expected no less than that from the people he coached. He felt that when people could be so authentic as to bring their full selves to work, they would be more respected by their colleagues, and would appreciate it more when others did the same. Brad Smith, former Intuit CEO, and Shelley Archambault, former CEO of MetricStream, received similar advice from Bill. Brad is from West Virginia and sports a strong accent. Early in his career, he was advised to get speech training to lose it. He decided not to. "I realize my accent isn't a bug, it's a feature," Brad now says, perfectly mixing Silicon Valley parlance with West Virginia drawl. People prefer leaders who are different because it makes leadership seem more attainable. Shelley is an African-American, and early in her career, when she was in sales at IBM, she tried to shed her cultural background and dress and act like everyone else. Bill helped her past that. "He encouraged me to dress however I felt most comfortable, because people can tell when you're not being yourself," she says. "Then they try to figure out why not, and that breeds distrust." Full identity, front and center. People are most effective when they can be completely themselves and bring their full identity to work. These are the elements that formed the foundation of Bill's success as an executive coach, and that those who benefited from his coaching took with them when they became coaches to their own colleagues and direct reports, too. He started by building trust, which only deepened over time. He was highly selective in choosing his coachees. He would only coach the coachable, the humble, hungry, lifelong learners. He listened intently, without distraction. He usually didn't tell you what to do. Rather, he shared stories and let you draw conclusions. He gave and demanded complete candor. And he was an evangelist for courage, by showing inordinate confidence and setting aspirations high. All of these created a remarkable environment when you were in the room with him. It was an atmosphere dedicated to making you better. As former CEO of eBay, John Donahoe, says, "It wasn't so much about the advice and insight he gave me. With Bill, you close your eyes and it's more about who he was. I felt it more than I heard it." Chapter 4. Team First. When Google went public in August 2004, it created two classes of stock. Class A shares were the ones sold to the public, each share coming with traditional voting rights. One share equals one vote. But Class B shares were different. Each share came with 10 votes. Class B shares were not sold publicly and were held by Google insiders, such as co-founders Larry Page and Sergey Brin, and CEO Eric. This dual-class structure ensured that Google's founders and executive team retained control of the company. This structure was unusual at the time and highly controversial, stirring public debate in the months leading up to the IPO. Early examples of companies with dual-class share structures include Ford, the New York Times Company, and Berkshire Hathaway. Since 2004, structures with differing voting rights for different stock classes have become more commonplace, being adopted by Facebook, LinkedIn, and Snap, among others. To Larry and Sergey, the structure was a critical element of their vision for the company. They admired Warren Buffett and had become knowledgeable about the dual-class stock structure that his company, Berkshire Hathaway, employed. They had always considered Google as much an institution as a business. They fervently believed in thinking long-term, making big bets and big investments in those bets, without having to consider the quarterly ups and downs of public markets. They were concerned that Google would lose this think-big propensity once it was a public company, and they saw the dual-class stock structure as a way to guard against that happening. Their interests would always be aligned with that of shareholders, they reasoned, because long-term thinking and investing was the best way to maximize value for everyone. Eric found himself at the center of this debate. After many hours talking with the founders, he became convinced that theirs was the best approach. He believed it would keep Google on track, not just in its current businesses, but in its broader mission of organizing the world's information. And it would actually lead to the creation of greater shareholder value than the traditional structure. He made this case to the board, but there was still a lot of open discussion. At the same time, some board members had been mulling over the idea of bringing in a new chairman of the board, someone who was more independent of the company, and the discussion on the dual stock classes pushed them even further in that direction. They asked Eric if he would step aside as chairman. He would remain as CEO. Eric was hurt by this stance. He felt he had done a good job in his 3 years as chairman and CEO, and, as far as he knew, the board agreed. He had earned the trust of the founders and employees. The company had performed very well, and they were about to go public. And for that, they wanted to remove him as chairman? He got on a call with Bill and gave his perspective on the situation. "What are you going to do?" Bill asked. In a moment full of pride and hurt, Eric said, "I'm going to quit Google." "Okay," Bill said. "When?" At that moment, as the coach of Google's executive team, Bill became a critical player in the future of the company. The greatest team in technology was about to break up. Bill couldn't let it happen. The meeting with the board where all this would be decided, where Eric was going to step down not just as chairman, but maybe as CEO too, was on Thursday, a couple of days hence. Bill got to work. Bill Campbell was a coach of teams. He built them, shaped them, put the right players in the right positions, and removed the wrong players from the wrong positions, cheered them on, and kicked them in their collective butt when they were underperforming. He knew, as he often said, that you can't get anything done without a team. This is an obvious point in the realm of sports, but it's often underappreciated in business. You can only really succeed and accomplish things through the collective, the common purpose, Lee C. Bollinger says. There are so many ways in which people don't understand this, and even when they do understand it, they don't know how to do it. That's where Bill's genius was. Bill's guiding principle was that the team is paramount, and that the most important thing he looked for and expected in people was a team-first attitude. Teams are not successful unless every member is loyal and will, when necessary, subjugate their personal agenda to that of the team. That the team wins has to be the most important thing. Perhaps Charles Darwin said it best in his book, The Descent of Man. A tribe including many members who, from possessing in a high degree the spirit of patriotism, fidelity, obedience, courage, and sympathy, were always ready to aid one another and to sacrifice themselves for the common good, would be victorious over most other tribes, and this would be natural selection. Back in 2004, Bill correctly assessed that feelings were rubbed raw over the pending IPO, the discussions on how to structure the company, and the idea that Eric stepped down as chairman. He understood that Eric was hurt, but he also knew that the team needed him to stay. He also felt that Eric was the best person to be the company's chairman, at that point and for the foreseeable future. So he thought about the situation and called Eric back the next day. "You can't leave. The team needs you," he stated. "How about if you step down as chairman for now and remain as CEO? And then at some point, not too far from now, Bill would see to it that Eric got reinstated as chairman." He He'd offered a reasonable compromise and appealed to Eric's loyalty to Google. "This was not a fight to have today," he told Eric. "Your pride is getting in the way of what's best for the company and for you." Eric saw that Bill was right, and he had no doubt that Bill could implement what he was proposing, so Eric agreed. Together they talked through how the board meeting the next day would go, and by the time Thursday rolled around, Eric was well prepared. He stepped down as chairman and stayed on as CEO. Later, in 2007, he was reinstated as chairman, a role he held until April 2011. He was executive chairman from that date until January 2018. Many people might look at Eric's short-lived decision to leave Google as completely crazy. Look how much stock he would be leaving behind. But in teams, and particularly high-performing teams, other things matter too. It's not just about money. Purpose, pride, ambition, ego, these are vital motivators as well, and must be considered by any manager or coach. Bill knew that he had to appeal to Eric both emotionally and rationally. His suggested compromise worked. At the time he proposed the compromise, Bill did not have everyone's agreement that Eric would be reinstated as chairman down the road. He simply knew that it was the right thing to do for the company, and that, as the coach, he had the influence to make things like that happen. Bill's integrity and his long record of sound judgment were paramount. When the time was right, when the IPO was done and emotions had simmered down, Bill would make the case to reinstate Eric as chairman, which is exactly what happened. This was an example of high-stakes team building, with a multi-billion-dollar IPO at stake and investors, founders, and executives debating difficult issues. But it is in precisely these situations that a team coach is needed the most, someone who can see past individual egos and understand the value that all of the members combined create. Team building is vital at every company, and the principles Bill espoused apply at every level of an organization. But it gets a lot harder to hold a team together at senior levels in companies, where egos and ambitions are considerable. Senior executives may have access to individual executive coaching, but team coaches at that level are more rare. After all-star teams may have coaches, but they aren't really coaching. They usually just sit back and enjoy the show. So why should executive teams, which consist of presumably the most talented people in the company, need a coach? "It was bizarre to me when I first joined the company," Patrick Pichette says. "You have all these amazing people at Google. Why would they need a coach?" In fact, it's nearly impossible to overstate Bill's influence in nurturing the Google management team during the company's formative years, an influence that continued until he passed away. As Omid Kordestani, former Google head of sales, puts it, "What was very special about Google was the community aspect of the senior team. Bill was the glue in that process." So, as a coach of teams, what would Bill do? His first instinct was always to work the team, not the problem. In other words, he focused on the team's dynamics, not on trying to solve the team's particular challenges. That was their job. His job was team building, assessing people's talents, and finding the doers. He ran toward the biggest problems, the stinkers that fester and cause tension. He focused on winning, but winning right, and he doubled down on his core values when things turned south. And he brought resolution by filling the gaps between people, listening, observing, and then seeking people out in behind-the-scenes conversations that brought teams together. "You always had the sense he was building a team," says Sheryl Sandberg. "With Bill, it wasn't executive coaching or career coaching. It was never just about me. It was always about the team." Work the team, then the problem. At a Google meeting a few years ago, the group was discussing an issue related to costs in some of the developing businesses. Ram Shriram raised concerns, The numbers were getting big. Shouldn't we get more details on how we are working on this? There was some back and forth, then Bill spoke up. Don't worry, he said. We have the right team in place. They are working the problem. I learned something from that, Rom says. Bill didn't work the problem first. He worked the team. We didn't talk about the problem analytically. We talked about the people on the team and if they could get it done. As managers, we tend to focus on the problem at hand. What is the situation? What are the issues? What are the options? And so on. These are valid questions, but the coach's instinct is to lead with a more fundamental one. Who was working on the problem? Was the right team in place? Did they have what they needed to succeed? When I became CEO of Google, Sundar Pichai says, Bill advised me that at that level, more than ever before, you need to bet on people. Choose your team. Think much harder about that. Bill helped us employ this approach in a problem that arose in 2010. Apple, and in particular Steve Jobs, believed that Google's Android operating system violated patents that Apple had developed for the iPhone. They sued Google's business partners, the manufacturers of Android phones. This wasn't just a business or a legal problem to Bill. It was personal. He was close friends with Jobs and a member of Apple's board, as well as an informal but influential coach to Google's leadership team. It was like his two children were fighting, with much more at stake than a favorite toy. Bill's approach was to focus on the team, not the problem. He never even offered an opinion on the relative merits of each side's case, even though he was quite knowledgeable about the issues and the phone features in question. He did, however, counsel Eric to put the right guy in charge of talking to Apple, Alan Eustace. Alan became the chief diplomat interfacing with Apple. It became his job to ensure that the relationship between the companies didn't implode. Much later in Bill's career, Google was planning an important change to its corporate structure. The company was forming a new holding company, to be called Alphabet, and moving some of its most speculative efforts, called Other Bets, out into separate companies. This new organization was a major shift in the operating structure and management culture. Sundar Pichai was being promoted to run Google, with Larry Page moving over to become CEO of Alphabet. Meanwhile, the company's head of sales, Nikesh Arora, had left, creating a big hole in one of the key leadership positions. The company contacted Omid Kordestani, its first head of sales. Would he be interested in coming back? It was clear at that point that we would be moving to Alphabet and that Sundar would be CEO of Google, Omid says. But it wasn't clear how we would get there. There were so many complex steps involved. When he talked to Bill, they didn't talk about the operational changes or any of the tactics or strategy involved. They talked about the team. Bill wanted someone who cared about the company and its people to help with the transition, which described Omid perfectly. Care for the team like that is unusual at that level, Omid says. It tends to be pretty cutthroat, but not for Bill. The management team was his primary love. Work the team, then the problem. When faced with a problem or opportunity, the first step is to ensure the right team is in place and working on it. Pick the right players. If you're running a company, you have to surround yourself with really, really good people, Bill said. Not one of his most surprising statements. It is a tired business mantra to always hire people smarter than yourself. Everybody that is managing a function on behalf of the CEO ought to be better at that function than the CEO. Some of the time, they are going to be wearing their HR hat or their IT hat, but most of the time, you want them to be wearing their company hat. These are all smart people that have great capabilities, and what you want to get is the best idea that comes from that group. Bill looked for four characteristics in people. The person has to be smart, not necessarily academically, but more from the standpoint of being able to get up to speed quickly in different areas and then make connections. Bill called this the ability to make far analogies. The person has to work hard and has to have high integrity. Finally, the person should have that hard-to-define characteristic, grit. The ability to get knocked down and have the passion and perseverance to get up and go at it again. He would tolerate a lot of other faults if he thought a person had those four characteristics. When he interviewed job candidates to assess these points, he wouldn't just ask about what a person did. He would ask how they did it. If the person said they led a project that led to revenue growth, asking how they achieved that growth will tell you a lot about how they were involved in the project. Were they hands-on? Were they doers? Did they build the team? He would listen for the pronouns. Does the person say I, could signify a me-first mentality, or we, a potential indicator of a team player? This is the rare instance where available research does not bear out Bill's principle. As James Pennebaker states in his book, The Secret Life of Pronouns, use of I versus we is not a good indicator of whether a person is a team player. Rather, it is an indicator of status. Lower status people, for example, individual contributors in a company, first-year students in a university, use I more often, while higher status people, executives, professors, use we more. We are not amused. A big turnoff for Bill was if they were no longer learning. Do they have more answers than questions? That's a bad sign. He looked for commitment to the cause and not just to their own success. Team first. You need to find, as Sundar Pichai says, people who understand that their success depends on working well together, that there's give and take. People who put the company first. Whenever Sundar and Bill found people like that, Sundar says, we would cherish them. But how do you know when you have found such a person? Keep note of the times when they give up things and when they are excited for someone else's success. Sundar notes that sometimes decisions come up and people have to give up things. I over-index on those signals when people give something up. And also when someone is excited because something else is working well in the company. It isn't related to them, but they are excited. I watch for that. Over-index is geek speak for pay a lot of attention to. Like when you see a player on the bench cheering for someone else on the team, like Steph Curry jumping up and down when Kevin Durant hits a big shot. You can't fake that. Steph Curry and Kevin Durant are stars on the NBA's Golden State Warriors, who had just won their third title in 4 years when Sundar, a big Warriors fan, said this. In 2011, Eric stepped down as Google's CEO. In the ensuing reorganization, Jonathan's job as head of products was eliminated. He was considering a few options, including running the enterprise business, now Google Cloud, a multi-billion-dollar division, but decided to decline them all. He felt hurt by the reorg and considered these other jobs a demotion. Bill was so disappointed. Jonathan was putting his bruised ego ahead of what was best for the Google team, and in fact himself. He was making a mistake born of ego and emotion, and Bill thought Jonathan maybe should consider removing his head from his ass. Bill suggested that Jonathan take more time to consider his decision, and he continued to meet with him on a regular basis. With Bill's help, Jonathan later found his way back into the Google fold by taking on other roles. Bill didn't give up on him, but he also never let him forget how he had let the team down. This was a vivid and personal lesson. When change happens, the priority has to be what is best for the team. Bill valued courage, the willingness to take risks, and the willingness to stand up for what's right for the team, which may entail taking a personal risk. Earlier in his Google career, before he became CEO, Sundar Pichai would often speak up when he felt something wasn't the right choice, both to us and later to Larry Page when he was CEO. That takes some guts, but as Sundar says, Bill always appreciated it when I spoke my mind about difficult issues, because he knew I cared about the company and the products, and that's where I was coming from. Sundar respects the same in others when he sees it today. There are people who are team players and really care about the company. When they speak up, it matters a lot to me, because I know they are coming from the right place. Bill was attracted to people who were difficult, more outspoken in their opinions, occasionally abrasive, not afraid to buck trends or the crowd. Like diamonds that are somehow misshapen, is how Alan Eustace puts it. Bill's friendship with Steve Jobs was a testament to this, as was his long partnership with other founders, Larry Page and Sergey Brin of Google, Scott Cook of Intuit. Not an easygoing person among them. We don't think Bill sought this out as a personality trait, but he tolerated it and even embraced it. Whereas others might find this type of person difficult, Bill found these people interesting and worth developing, sometimes helping them smooth away rough edges. The most effective coaches tolerate and even encourage some level of eccentricity and prickliness among their team members. Outstanding performers, from athletes to founders to business executives, are often difficult. You want them on your team. Sheryl Sandberg says that the first time she met Bill, during her first week at Google in late 2001, he asked her, "What do you do here?" At the time, Sheryl had been hired with the title of Business Unit General Manager, a position that didn't exist before she arrived. There were, in fact, no business units, so she had nothing to manage. She answered by saying that she used to be at the Treasury Department. He stopped her. "Okay, but what do you do here?" This time, she replied with ideas of what she thought she might do. Bill wasn't satisfied. "But what do you do here?" Sheryl finally copped to the truth. So far, she didn't do anything. "I learned an incredibly important lesson," she says. "It's not what you used to do. It's not what you think. It's what you do every day." This is perhaps the most important characteristic Bill looked for in his players. People who show up, work hard, and have an impact every day. Doers. As you evaluate people, it's important to consider how they fit in the team and the company. People, especially in Silicon Valley, tend to look for superheroes, people with superior smarts and savvy who can do it all and be the best at everything. This is magnified at companies' senior levels. As Philip Schindler says, "Bill made the point that you don't want to staff a team with just quarterbacks. You need to pay a lot of attention to the team composition and have a diverse set of different talents smartly woven together." All people have their limitations. What's important is to understand them individually, to identify what makes them different, and then to see how you can help them mesh with the rest of the team. Bill appreciated high cognitive abilities, but he also understood the value of soft skills, like empathy, that aren't always valued in businesses, especially tech ones. At Google, he helped us learn to appreciate that this combination, smarts and hearts, creates better managers. He did not overemphasize experience. He looked at skills and mindset, and he could project what you could become. This is a coach's talent, the ability to see a player's potential, not just current performance. Maybe not completely accurately, as Stanford professor Carol Dweck points out in her 2006 book Mindset, someone's true potential is unknowable, since it's impossible to foresee what can be accomplished with years of passion, toil, and training. But even without that accuracy, you can bet on potential enough to avoid writing off people solely because they lack experience. The general tendency is to hire for experience. "I'm hiring for job X, so I want someone who has years of experience doing job X." If you are creating a high-performing team and building for the future, you need to hire for potential as well as experience. Picking the right players can also entail reconsidering who else within the company should be on the team. When Jonathan ran the product team at Google, his staff included several product management leaders. But because of how the company was organized, it did not include engineering leaders. This led to some conflict when it came time to allocate and assign people and resources. The product leads didn't always agree with the engineering leads. Jonathan's staff meetings often involved a lot of argument about these decisions, and some complaining about the absent engineering leads. Bill's counsel to Jonathan was simple. Add some players to the team. Jonathan should invite the engineering leads to his staff meeting. Not to just one meeting, but permanently. Then force the discussion of plans with them, air the arguments, and get everyone to buy in on whatever decisions were made. The purpose of the meetings was not for Jonathan to demonstrate command of topics discussed and tell people what to do, which, as Bill observed, was sometimes Jonathan's practice. It was to get the team to gel. Bringing in the people who were a focal point of dissension was the only way to do that. Sure, there were still plenty of arguments, but because more of the players were in the room, they got resolved more quickly, which helped create stronger relationships across groups. Bill started to show a knack for picking players early in his business career. Eric Johnson was a colleague of Bill's at Kodak. Eric says that at the time, Kodak was very profitable, so it wasn't too concerned with getting rid of mediocre performers. Bill wasn't one to make heads roll either. He got better at dealing with poor performers later on, when he had to, as CEO of Intuit. However, at Kodak, he developed a talent for finding the doers in any department and getting those people talking. This isn't always easy in a large company, but Bill would look for those same characteristics he looked for in candidates: smarts, hard work, integrity, grit. And then he would figure out ways to formally, or informally, bring those people together to talk and make stuff happen around a particular project or problem. People would look forward to the meeting with Bill, Eric recounts, because when Campbell ran a meeting or brought a group together, the environment was results-oriented. Everyone participated and contributed, and they actually enjoyed the meeting. It was positive and fun to be part of a team. Pick the right players. The top characteristics to look for are smarts and hearts, the ability to learn fast, a willingness to work hard, integrity, grit, empathy, and a team-first attitude. Pair people. As we noted earlier, Bill highly valued peer relationships. An important, often overlooked, aspect of team building is developing relationships within the team. This can happen organically, but it is important enough that it should not be left to chance. So Bill looked for any opportunity to pair people up. Take a couple of people who don't usually work together, assign them a task, project, or decision, and let them work on it on their own. This develops trust between the two people, usually regardless of the nature of the work. This was one of Bill's first suggestions to Jonathan. A 1995 study by Daniel McAllister of Georgetown University shows that trust increases with the frequency of interaction between a manager and a peer. After sitting in on a couple of his staff meetings, Bill told Jonathan that he needed to work more on coaching people and pairing them up on things. Don't just be a dictator assigning tasks, pair people up. So from that point forward, for projects such as preparing material for public events like earnings calls, producing team off-sites, working on compensation and promotion ladders, and developing internal tools, Jonathan stopped dictating and started pairing people up. The results? Better decisions, stronger team. Bill would coach Jonathan to do this himself. When Patrick Pichette joined Google as CFO, Bill asked Jonathan to seek him out and mentor him on the ways of the company. This was helpful to Patrick, but it also helped create a new trusted pair relationship on Eric's management team, which was the actual objective. The deliverable matters, but what matters just as much is the opportunity for the pair of teammates to work together on something and get to know and trust each other. That is invaluable to the team's success. Pair people. Peer relationships are critical and often overlooked, so seek opportunities to pair people up on projects or decisions. The Peer Feedback Survey. Bill felt so strongly about the importance of peer relationships that he helped design a peer feedback survey we used for years at Google. Respondents gave feedback about colleagues, and the results provided a good picture of how well a person was performing in the eyes of their peers, the most important evaluators, in Bill's opinion. The survey was initially designed to elicit opinions on four aspects of a person's performance: job performance, relationship with peer groups, management and leadership, and innovation. Later, Bill insisted that it be expanded to include a question about people's behavior in meetings. He was dismayed by how many people chose to be on their phones or laptops in meetings. We added a question about collaboration as well, and a set of questions on product vision that went just to product leaders. You can find the complete survey in the enhancement. Get to the table. In the 1980s, the majority of executives at technology companies were men. There were very few women. Deb Biondolillo was one of those women, the head of U.S. human resources at Apple. Still, when the weekly CEO staff meeting rolled around, Deb would sit in the row of chairs along the wall, not at the table. Bill couldn't stand this. "What are you doing back there?" he would ask Deb. "Get to the table." Finally, one day Deb got to the meeting early and nervously grabbed a seat at the table. The other guys filtered in, and one of them, Al Eisenstadt, ended up sitting next to Deb. Al was a dynamic executive, Apple's general counsel, and one of its heads of marketing prior to Bill, a powerful man who was instrumental to Apple's early growth. He was also well known for being rather gruff. When he took his seat that day, he was surprised to see Deb sitting next to him at the table.
"What are you doing here?" he barked.
"Going to the meeting," she replied, with more confidence than she felt. "Al looked at me for a few seconds," Deb says. "Then he looked over at Bill. That's when I knew it would be okay. Bill would back me up." 3 decades later, women still constitute a minority of executives in technology. A 2016 U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission report states that 20% of high-tech execs are women, while a 2018 Entello Women in Tech report pegs the number at 10%. More than anyone we have ever encountered in our careers, Bill was an advocate for women being at the table. He believed in diversity on teams well before it was a common topic. This is counterintuitive. Bill swore, loved football and a good dirty joke, perfected the guy's trip, and loved beer. He was a real guy's guy. Most of this guy activity, except for the swearing, took place outside the workplace, but not entirely. And it likely made at least some of the women around Bill feel excluded from time to time. Some women may not feel comfortable telling jokes over beers at a sports bar. Yet all of the women we talked to about Bill felt comfortable with his style, because they saw firsthand that Bill was a straight shooter who delivered tough messages with respect, warmth, and candor. We learned early on from Bill that when it came to creating teams, you have to put your bias blinders on, and that we all have biases. To him, it was simple. Winning depends on having the best team, and the best teams include more women. A pair of 2010 studies bear Bill out on this point. They examined collective intelligence in teams. Why are some teams smarter than the sum of their individual IQs? The answer is threefold. On the most effective teams, everyone contributes rather than one or two people dominating discussions. People on those teams are better at reading complex emotional states, and the teams have more women. This can be partly explained by the fact that women tend to be better at reading emotional states than men. So Bill always pushed us to consider women for any senior positions. He believed, "You can always find a woman for a job. It may just take a little longer." He helped recruit them when he could, such as when he got Ruth Porat to come on board as Google's CFO in 2015. He pushed the women he coached to be more aggressive in seeking bigger roles and more P&L responsibility, particularly in jobs outside of typical female areas such as HR or PR. P&L is profit and loss, having financial responsibility for a business unit or company. HR is human resources. PR is public relations. He connected successful women he knew with other successful women. He had zero tolerance for any gender bias in business conversations. Bill helped bring Eve Burton to the Intuit board and worked with her extensively in her role as SVP and general counsel at Hearst, the media conglomerate. He coached Eve on various content deals she was negotiating, and the two of them collaborated on a journalism and technology partnership between Columbia and Stanford. But none of this work was more important to Bill than the Hearst Lab, a business greenhouse for women-led companies that Eve started at Hearst under Bill's prodding and tutelage. Those companies now have a collective value of more than $200 million. "It was the last thing he pushed me to do," Eve says. "His vision was to give women a place to seed their companies and make them successful. And a place to get some grass stains, too." One day, Diane Greene was attending an Intuit board meeting when she and Bill started chatting about their kids. Diane's son was playing flag football at his middle school, and her daughter, in fifth grade, had complained that it wasn't fair that the boys got to play football and the girls didn't. Bill told Diane to come to Sacred Heart, the private school in nearby Atherton, on Thursday afternoon, and to bring her daughter. He didn't say why. When Diane and her daughter arrived, they saw a bunch of middle school girls practicing football. Bill was on the field coaching them, with as much energy and colorful language as he did the boys' team. "He wanted her to see that girls can play football too," Diane says. "He was coaching a football team. It didn't matter that it was girls. He found the time to fit it in and hardly even talked about it." He took time to talk to adult women's teams, too. For example, not long after she became CEO of Metric Stream, Shelley Archambault formed a group of women CEOs to support and mentor each other. She invited Bill to come to one meeting, and they all enjoyed it so much that it became a regular event. They would gather in the conference room at Bill's office in Palo Alto and spend a couple of hours talking about a particular topic du jour. Bill prepared for and usually orchestrated the meeting. He didn't tell the women what to do. Rather, he told stories about his experiences and asked questions. In most of the discussions, the fact that the CEOs around the table were all women didn't even come up and wasn't particularly relevant. However, when diversity did come up, or when some of the women related some of the biases they had experienced, Bill always got frustrated. He reminded them to think of the other women around the table when opportunities come up. This can be a problem. A 2017 Harvard Business Review article notes that sometimes members of minority groups hesitate to bring other members of that group into their organizations because they don't want to be perceived as giving special treatment, and they worry that the people they bring in might not make the grade. So Bill always told Shelley's group that if they were looking for board members, look around the group first. Shelley thought of Bill when she launched a diversity program for women at her company's office in Bangalore, India. They had more than 1,000 people there, 30% of whom were women, at the time a high percentage for a tech company in India. Not long after launching the program, she traveled to the office to check in on business and see how the initiative was going. She gathered the diversity committee and the leadership team into a conference room that was a bit too small. There were not enough chairs at the table for everyone. Shelley noticed that the women who filed in all took the chairs around the edge of the room. The men automatically sat at the table. She stopped them and instructed the women to sit at the table and the men to move to the outer chairs. Then she proceeded with the meeting. When it was over, she asked the men how it felt to be sitting against the wall, not at the table.
Weird and uncomfortable, they responded.
Exactly, she replied. To truly include everyone, everyone needs to be at the table. Get to the table. Winning depends on having the best team, and the best teams have more women. Solve the biggest problem. There is another issue with the largely cognitive approach to management, which we had big time at Google. Smart, analytical people, especially ones steeped in computer science and mathematics, as we were, will tend to assume that data and other empirical evidence can solve all problems. Quants, or techies with this worldview, tend to see the inherently messy emotional tension that's always present in teams of humans as inconvenient and irrational, an irritant that will surely be resolved in the course of a data-driven decision process. Of course, humans don't always work that way. Things come up, tensions arise, and they don't naturally go away. People do their best to avoid talking about these situations because they're awkward, which makes it worse. When that happens, people refer to the elephant in the room, the big problem that overshadows everything but that no one acknowledges. As former Avon CEO Andrea Jung says, "With Bill, there was never an elephant in the room." Or, more accurately, there might have been an elephant, but it wasn't hiding in the corner. Bill wouldn't allow that. He brought the thing front and center. It's a football mentality, Shona Brown points out. Where's the weakest link on the offensive line or the defensive secondary? Throughout her tenure at Google, Shona worked weekly with Bill, tackling numerous operational issues, many of which were lurking like elephants in the corner. The company was just growing so fast, well ahead of any semblance of process. Bill's approach, Shona says, was always to tackle the hardest problem first. You have to address that first. A litmus test for when issues have simmered for too long, a way to spot the elephant, is if the team can't even have honest conversations about them. This is where the coach comes in, as a tension spotter. Of course, another word for tension is politics. When you hear people saying that things are getting political, that often means that problems have arisen because the data or process hasn't led to the best decision. At that point, personalities take over. As we discussed earlier, this was anathema to Bill. "For us, political stuff is very toxic," he wrote Jonathan. "We have managed to become a big company with a wonderful absence of politics." The reason we accomplished that, he failed to mention, was his own diligence in tackling the toughest, ugliest problems head-on. He would, as former Google head of communications Rachel Whetstone says, beat the politics out of the situation by bringing up the problem clearly, then forcing everyone to focus on it. There was one situation we had a few years ago where two different product leaders were arguing about which team should manage a particular group of products. Both could legitimately argue that the products belonged on their team. For a while, this was treated as a technical discussion, where data and logic would eventually determine which way to go. But that didn't happen. The problem festered, and tensions rose. It was causing problems within the teams and with external partners as well. Who was in control? This is when Bill got involved. There had to be a difficult meeting where one exec would win and the other would lose. Bill made the meeting happen. He spotted a fundamental tension that was not getting resolved and forced the issue. He didn't have a clear opinion on how to resolve the matter, on which team the product belonged. He simply knew we had to decide one way or another now. It was one of the most heated meetings we've had, but it had to happen.
solve the biggest problem. Identify the biggest problem, the elephant in the room, bring it front and center, and tackle it first. Don't let the bitch sessions last.